It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Three NASA astronauts and a Russian cosmonaut arrive at the International Space Station for a six-month stay. Here's Crew 8 co-pilot Michael Barrett in remarks at the hatch opening, talking with Mission Control at Space Center Houston.
Just a big shout-out to all the folks who got us up here from NASA, our friends at SpaceX for building a great little spaceship and a little taste of the flexibility this morning that we'll be expecting over the next 6 months.
As we discuss lunar missions and the space economy, call in with a question. Share your comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Jeff Faust is a senior staff writer for Space News. Jeff, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Good morning. Ryan Watkins here as well, program scientist in NASA's Exploration Science Strategy and Integration Office at the agency's headquarters in Washington, D.C. Ryan, welcome back.
Good morning, Kate.
Good morning. So, Ryan, you know, NASA's create their docking at the International Space Station. We see the swapping of crews, the hugs that are immediately occur, and the excitement. What might the crew be doing while they are in the low Earth orbit in this, you know, quote unquote floating laboratory?
Yeah, that's a good question. And just for context, I don't do a lot with the International Space Station side of things, mm-hmm. but I can tell you that the crew has a variety of activities that they're going to be doing while they're, you know, orbiting Earth on the ISS. They'll be conducting some experiments. You know, we've got scientific payloads and experiments that are on board the ISS. So they have time built into their daily schedules to do those. They're doing a lot of human biology experiments to understand what happens to the human body when you're in space for long durations of time. You know, they'll spend some time exercising. They'll do calls with children or other public engagement efforts. Basically, they stay pretty busy the whole time they're up there with very detailed schedules laid out for them.
It makes me wonder, though, is the International Space Station a good place for this type of work and collaboration that could perhaps one day be replicated on the moon? Or, you know, this cooperation that you see at this station, could that be applicable with what could happen on the moon?
Yeah, definitely. There are definitely also some differences between, you know, low Earth orbit and the lunar environment. You know, you've got differences in radiation and gravity and things like that. But low Earth orbit is a really great place for us to just understand the physiological effects of space on, again, on the human body and how we adapt to that in space or react to it. So it's a good place to kind of understand that before we go to the lunar surface or lunar orbit for longer periods of time. It's really great for, you know, fostering our international collaborations. You know, you see a lot of that on the ISS with different countries sending astronauts and resources and things. And that's something we hope to continue in low Earth orbit. As well as, you know, just learning how to conduct experiments, whether it be, you know, kind of in a space station type environment or adapting those to later be used on the surface of a planetary body. So there are a lot of really great analogs. We're learning a lot about just how to, you know, how humans and robots kind of interface and how we can use the humans to conduct experiments and do other things that we hope to do when we get to the lunar environment as well.
Turning to you, Jeff Faust at Space News, you know, so the SpaceX rocket holding Crew 8 delayed its launch for several days due to poor weather. What comes up for you as you see this crew change at the International Space Station?
Well, I think it's a demonstration of the growing role that the private sector is playing in spaceflight today. NASA used to use the space shuttle to send astronauts to the space station. Once the shuttle was retired in 2011, we had to rely on the Russians and their Soyuz spacecraft to get to the space station. But now we have SpaceX with their Crew Dragon spacecraft that is able to send astronauts to and from the space station and do so as a commercial service. SpaceX owns and operates the spacecraft, and basically NASA is using that spacecraft for its needs to support the ISS. And there's a second company, Boeing, developing its own crewed spacecraft called Starliner that will be flying to the space station with astronauts on board for the first time around the end of April. So it's a demonstration of the growing capabilities of the private sector that NASA can increasingly rely on as it focuses on some of the more critical deep space exploration activities it's performing.
So you would consider NASA to be like SpaceX's number one customer in a way at the moment?
Yeah, definitely. NASA is SpaceX's biggest customer, along with other parts of the federal government for satellite launches as well. But SpaceX obviously has a lot of commercial business as well. But certainly, SpaceX and other companies are providing key capabilities that NASA increasingly relies on to carry out activities in low Earth orbit, like the space station, as it works on the Artemis program to send astronauts to the moon.
Talking with Jeff Faust, Space News senior staff writer, and Ryan Watkins is here, NASA program scientist, as we talk about the moon and space exploration. Call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Ryan, let's talk about the Artemis mission. In January, NASA announced its Artemis space program plans to land astronauts on the moon in 2026. How likely is that timeline?
Yeah, it's a great question. So 2026 is the timeline we're working towards for our first crewed mission through the Artemis program that will land on the surface of the moon. So this will be the first time we've sent humans back to the surface in over 50 years. So that is the timeline we're working towards. The announcement that came out in January was a delay from our original timeline of 2024. So the end of this year was the original goal. But, there's a lot of work that has to go into getting humans on another planetary body. So we're working towards that 2026 date, and that's holding right now. There is an Artemis II mission coming up before that that will be an orbital mission. So we will have humans in orbit around the moon, but the first landing is 2026,
okay.
I think September timeframe.
Why return astronauts to the moon? Why should this be a top priority for NASA?
Yeah, there's actually a lot of really great reasons to send humans back to the moon. Some of the three kind of primary reasons that NASA likes to think about are first and foremost, scientific discovery. There are a lot of things that humans can do on the surface of the moon that robots just can't do as easily, at least, or as well. So when we sent Apollo to the moon, we really only explored a very small area on the surface of the moon. And so with Artemis, we're going to a whole new region. We're planning to go to the South Polar region of the moon, which is rich in resources that we can use for longer duration space flight. So things like, water and oxygen and stuff that you need for crewed exploration. And so sending humans instead of just robots allows us to do things more efficiently, more quickly. The human eye is well trained on recognizing certain samples and being like, that's the one that I need. Whereas with robots, you got a lot of iterations back and forth. You've got folks on, the ground control side that have to analyze things and tell the robot where to go. So humans are just a lot more efficient in that regard. So it enables us to do a lot more scientific discovery by exploring a new region that has different, rock types and resources and things that we didn't see with Apollo. There are also a lot of economic benefits to sending humans to the moon. We're also partnering with commercial companies, like Jeff just mentioned, for a lot of these efforts, SpaceX and Blue Origin being two of them. There are others as well. We've got commercial vendors developing our spacesuits. We're just doing a lot to really kind of build up a lunar economy and really boost some of these commercial companies as we look towards going back to the moon. And then finally, go ahead.
I was going to say, and then there are these private companies trying to land things on the moon. And I want to bring up the first privately built spacecraft landing on the moon in February. And here is a former NPR science correspondent, Joe Pelka, on our sister program Central Time discussing the Intuitive Machines lander.
It was always private companies that were involved. NASA doesn't make all this stuff itself. Mm-hmm. But now this other company is running the show, essentially, and the control room is in their building, not in NASA a base around the country.
So, Jeff, how is the role of private companies in space exploration expanding?
Well, as you mentioned, we're now using private companies to land payloads on the moon, something that used to only be done by big government space agencies. And with the Intuitive Machines landing last month, they were the first company to successfully land on the moon. All the previous landings on the moon dating back to the beginning of the space age more than 60 years ago were done by governments, by NASA, by the Soviets, by China, India, Japan. they had all been done by government agencies. We've now seen the growth in private sector capabilities, much like we've seen that capabilities grow to support the International Space Station to be able to send payloads to the moon and one day send people to the moon to support the Artemis program. And sort of being able to leverage these capabilities is a way to both grow the economy, but also to sort of, you know, leverage capabilities that allows NASA to focus on the sort of the really hard things that only a space agency can do.
Real hard things, Ryan. I'm wondering how much room for failure or how much trial and error is there for these companies learning to land things on the moon? I mean, there was concern that this lander had tipped over as it landed.
Yeah, no, that's a question we definitely get a lot with our Commercial Lunar Payload Services or CLPS program. So NASA is very aware of the risks of this program. It is kind of, you know, we're accepting a larger degree of risk than we may, you know, do with some of our other missions. We're really committed to supporting our commercial vendors as they navigate these difficult tasks of sending, you know, scientific and technology payloads and demonstrations to the moon. And so there's not like a quantifiable answer to that, but we do recognize that there will be failures, there will be successes, there will be, you know, everything in between those two. You know, even with Intuitive Machines, while yes, they did tip over during landing, you know, we still got a lot of data, a lot of lessons learned, we got our payloads on. So we're kind of using all of those lessons moving forward, looking to our next flights to see, you know, how we can improve. We know that our commercial vendors are all learning from each other as well. They've been very open with their communication so far. We're accepting a higher level of risk and just kind of evolving as we go.
Ryan Watkins there, a NASA program scientist focused on the moon. Jeff Faust, senior staff writer at Space News, as we discuss the latest on space exploration and the moon. Be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. NASA's budget would be nearly $24 billion under spending appropriations Congress is preparing to act on. That analysis in the journal Science, citing NASA's program funding is reduced in some areas due to Congress's growing uneasiness about rising costs for several major missions. As we discuss the space economy, call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We have Ryan Watkins, a program specialist at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C. Jeff Faust is here, senior staff writer at Space News. Jeff, Congress has passed several resolutions in recent months to continue temporarily funding the government at current spending levels. Are these temporary spending measures affecting NASA's budget and its long-term plans?
Yeah, I mean, the stopgap funding bills force NASA to make decisions about how to support future programs for 2024 when they're not certain how much money they will eventually get when Congress passes that 2024 final spending bill. And one of the programs that was affected by that is called Mars Sample Return. And as the name suggests, it's a program to collect samples from the surface of Mars, which the Perseverance rover is doing right now, and then bring them back to Earth. And the separate House and Senate spending bills last year proposed vastly different amounts of money, more than a factor of three difference for Mars Sample Return. And so NASA went into this series of continuing resolutions or stopgap spending bills, deciding to assume that they would get only the lower level and plan accordingly so that they didn't spend too much before the final bills got passed. And what that led to is some cutbacks in the Mars Sample Return program, particularly at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, which is the lead center for Mars Sample Return, and that forced JPL to lay off more than 500 people, or about 8% of its workforce, last month because of that continued uncertainty. Now, that uncertainty is coming to an end. Congress is going to pass this week a final fiscal year 2024 spending bill. There's still some details up in the air about just how much money Mars Sample Return will get, but it'll provide a little bit more certainty for NASA in terms of how much money it will get overall, and so it can plan accordingly for Mars sample return and its other science and exploration programs.
But wouldn't these latest appropriations cut spending to NASA compared to 2023 levels?
Yeah, the bill would provide a little less than $25 billion for NASA overall in 2024. NASA got a little over $25 billion in 2023 and was asking for more than $27 billion for 2024. So to see your proposed budget get cut by effectively 10% from what you asked for requires tightening some belts. Now, that gets done unevenly across the agency because some programs get pretty much all the money that they requested, some see steeper cuts. So you have to go through really on a program by program basis, depending on how much money Congress allocates for them and deciding, you know, what to cut, what to delay, and what can move forward.
Ryan, how could the flat spending or cuts by the federal government impact our lunar aspirations and our scientific discoveries for the moon?
Yeah, I think Jeff answered this one very well. Like he said, it's very program by program dependent. And so at least on the side where, you know, we're looking at lunar programs, you know, we currently have a lot of different things we're funding. We have Artemis, we have, you know, a variety of different programs, like even under Artemis with, you know, instruments and science teams and technology and all sorts of different things. And so the agency, we have, you know, like priorities, you know, Artemis is definitely one of those. It's very possible the funding cuts could affect certain areas of that. You know, I don't know yet which ones, but probably what will happen is we'll look at some of our, you know, things that are prioritized maybe a little bit lower than Artemis and have to make some cuts there. We're very committed to, you know, continuing our funding for our high priority missions and objectives, which would include human lunar exploration. So again, there may be some areas where we see some funding cuts, but I don't think it will hurt the Artemis program overall too terribly. So we will continue to go forward with that.
Ryan Watkins there, NASA program scientist. Jeff Faust with us at Space News. Call in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Jeff, these NASA contracts with private space companies, like we've talked about SpaceX, Blue Origin, for help with its lunar ambitions, what do you see into the future, the role of these types of companies in NASA missions?
Well, I think the role will continue to grow as these companies demonstrate their capabilities, and that will take some time. Inevitably, there will be some setbacks and such, but I think overall you're seeing it growing because it has been growing already for more than 15 years. We started with transporting cargo to the space station commercially. Now we're transporting astronauts to the space station commercially. We're sending, you know, robotic payloads to the moon with commercial landers. Soon we'll be doing that with astronauts. So we'll see those capabilities continue to grow so long as companies can demonstrate that they can, you know, fulfill their contracts with NASA.
In terms, Ryan, of how NASA is educating about the work it's doing. There's the blog sharing developments in the Artemis program. How accessible is NASA's space exploration information and its goals to the public who are not involved in these missions?
Yeah, I would say it's very accessible. Sometimes you know, just got to pick your favorite platform that you want to go get the information from. But so NASA does broadcast a lot of our information. We've got NASA TV. There's, you know, often live coverage there of not only, you know, ISS exploration with crew, but, you know, we've covered our CLPS launches and landings on there and a whole other variety of things. You know, NASA is very active on X and Instagram and Facebook and all of those, you know, pick your favorite platform, mm-hmm. and we're on it. So the information is very accessible. And obviously you can always go to our website, nasa.gov as well.
And, you know, I was watching the hatch opening and the welcome remarks on the International Space Station. And I noticed as they gathered all the astronauts together, Mission Control Houston said, "Can you remove that wire that is sticking a little bit out? I see it in the picture. It's about, you know," I mean, to me, the untrained eye, I mean, I can see what they're talking about, but it demonstrated just how important that their image might be and how carefully they want that attention to detail in the image. And I'm just wondering, Ryan, what does that tell you, or does that speak to you in any way?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't see that particular clip, but when I see things like that, it always amazes me at just how well our teams are trained. You know, they see those things that, you know, us, you know, as the public might be watching and don't even notice. It shows that, you know, yeah, I mean, that maybe it's a public image thing of, hey, just get this wire out of the way so we have a good shot. Or maybe it's a safety thing, like, hey, get this wire out of the way, we don't want someone to trip on it. You know, there's probably multiple factors that go into that. You know, NASA, you know, we're really good at, you know, just displaying all this stuff publicly. We're not trying to soften our image or anything, but, you know, we do want, you know, the public to be very excited about what they see when they're watching our astronauts. And so we do take great care and pride in that.
Ryan Watkins, NASA program scientist focused on the moon. Jeff Faust, senior staff writer at Space News. Call in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We take stock of the U.S. space program, the growth of the commercial space industry with the likes of SpaceX and the effects of a global space competition for the moon's south pole, where scientists have detected traces of water ice. We'll get into that. Call in with a question. Add your perspective. 800-642-1234. We have Space News senior writer Jeff Faust with us and NASA program scientist Ryan Watkins here as well. Ryan, we heard from Frank in Springbrook called in to ask, how many space missions will it take to set up a base on the moon? And Frank is also wondering about what will be the cargo needed and those logistics.
Yeah, that's a really great question. I don't think I have a number answer to give you. It will definitely take more than one. So with the Artemis program, we are looking towards, you know, establishing some kind of, you know, permanent or semi-permanent base in the south polar region of the moon. So it will take a lot of precursor missions to get the supplies up there that we need, you know, the habitats that the astronauts might live or work in, the resources they'll need, whether it be, you know, oxygen, food, et cetera. So I don't know exactly how many, but that's definitely something that NASA is actively thinking about and working towards. I don't remember what the second half of that question was. I think it was about logistics.
Logistics, which what I would imagine, you know, setting up a base there and what might be involved with that.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, that's a really good question. I think something we're kind of still sorting out. You know, we obviously know that we'll need a place for the astronauts to sleep. We need a laboratory for them to work in. We need, you know, airlocks and all of these various things. We need rovers so that they can go distances well beyond the area where they're living and working. We'll need different robotic instruments to help with mining resources or doing experiments or conducting science. So there's a lot of logistics involved. And luckily, you know, we've got these great partnerships with our commercial vendors as well now. And so a lot of them have, you know, cargo landers as well as human rated landers. And so it'll be a delicate balance to get all of the supplies up there we need. But I would say as Artemis continues to move forward in the next few years, definitely keep your ears out because you'll start to hear a lot more about our plans for longer duration human stays on the moon.
Jeff, last summer, India becomes the fourth country to successfully land an object on the moon. How is NASA working with other national space agencies to achieve its goals? And what do you see around the world as you look to how countries are approaching the moon?
Yeah, that's a great question. International partnerships are a key part of the Artemis effort. NASA is working with Europe and Japan and Canada and other countries on elements of Artemis. That includes something called the Gateway, which will be sort of a little mini space station orbiting the moon that will serve as sort of a base camp for which astronauts will go down to the lunar surface from, to and from the lunar surface. You know, and the Gateway will consist of modules provided not just by NASA, but also by Europe and Japan and also the United Arab Emirates. They'll be contributing a module as well. And certainly as Artemis grows in the future, you'll see additional opportunities. Europe has talked about developing a lander for delivering cargo to the moon, provide some of the logistics we were just talking about that would be needed for a lunar base. Japan wants to develop a rover that would be able to be used by astronauts for long traverses across the lunar surface. So there's plenty of opportunities for those and other countries as well to participate in Artemis.
Ryan, China and America have plans to explore the lunar south pole in coming years. Why explore the southern reaches of the moon? Why is there this such interest in the southern reaches?
Yeah, there's a few reasons, one of which I mentioned earlier in the broadcast, that the south polar region has a lot of permanently shadowed regions. So these are areas that essentially never see sunlight. And so in these areas, we can we've detected that there are areas of water ice. These are great resources, obviously, for human exploration. If we want to stay for longer periods of time, you know, we can go and harvest these and use them for different applications. So that's one reason. Another is that, you know, we've never been to this area. There's whole new rock types that can tell us about the formation and evolution of the moon. We're going to be landing in some of the oldest terrains on the moon. So understanding exactly how old these terrains are and what the rock types are can tell us a lot about the evolution of the early moon, as well as the evolution of the Earth-Moon system. So it tells us a lot about our own planet. I do also want to say that while we're going to the South Polar region, that doesn't mean the other areas on the moon aren't also scientifically interesting. So we'll be exploring the entire lunar surface also with, you know, our robotic missions as well, even if we're not necessarily sending humans there right now.
Are human explorers like really the only way to get a definitive answer about whether there is water ice on the moon and what's going on with it?
So I would say that being on the surface of the moon is the only way to get the definitive answer. Okay. And there's a variety of ways we can do this. And I think kind of the best answer here is humans and robots working together. So in some of these permanently shadowed regions, there's often in the bottoms of craters that can be hard for crew to access. So if we bring crew and, you know, robotic rovers, for example, that are better able to traverse down into those areas, then the two working together is really useful. Sometimes you can have a robotic lander that can go in and take a sample of an area, and then the crew can go and retrieve it and bring it back later. So again, having humans there is really important because we can do things a lot more efficiently and quickly than robots, but we also need the robotic explorers as well to access some of these areas that are difficult for crew to get to.
Can you just even explain how valuable this water ice would be? Like what it would mean if crews didn't have to have water as part of their payload to get to the moon?
Yeah, so every pound or kilogram that you send to space, it doesn't even matter if you're going to the moon or not, but in this case to the moon, costs money. You know, the more mass that we send up on these spacecraft, the more expensive it is, the more difficult it is, the less room you have for other things, you know, more crew, more resources, more experiments, et cetera. So having resources readily accessible already on the surface of the moon would be really valuable because we could use those and not have to send as many supplies with the crew, thereby freeing up mass, saving money, et cetera. And again, it just kind of really helps us to use the resources there to enable sustained exploration for longer durations of time without necessarily needing to send as many resupply missions.
Talking about the moon and space exploration with Ryan Watkins, a NASA program specialist, Jeff Faust is here, Space News senior staff writer, and taking your questions at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Jeff, NASA Director Bill Nelson says America is in a space race with China to get to the moon, and America is winning. Do you agree that the countries are in a type of space race here?
There is certainly a competition between China and the United States to get astronauts to the moon this decade. China is developing a very ambitious lunar exploration program. They've sent several robotic missions to the moon already. There will be launching another one later this year that will go to the far side of the moon and collect samples to return them to Earth. And they've talked about plans to send astronauts to the moon again to that South Polar region because of the ices there that Ryan mentioned by the end of the decade. So there certainly is a competition between the two, which I think you can see as part of the broader geopolitical competition between China and the United States on the global stage. Space is just one aspect of that. But certainly, the United States is keeping a close eye on China and its growing space capabilities as it heads to the moon.
Your thoughts there, Ryan, on how geopolitical competition would impact the Artemis mission?
Yeah, so I would say, within NASA, with our Artemis program, we're not often focused on, competition with other countries. We do recognize that, China and other countries are looking at the South Polar region. Rather, we like to think about, cooperation and what can be done there. There are, some restrictions with China specifically, but as much as we can, we do talk to our international partners about, where they're planning to land, where we're planning to land. We have the Artemis Accords, which we've got several signatories from various countries, and a lot of countries agreeing to kind of work together with a common understanding of what we want to do with the Artemis program. Again, it's a little trickier with China, but we do try to stay aware of what they're doing and advertise kind of what we're doing so that we can work together as much as possible and avoid any conflicts as we're exploring similar areas.
Courtney in Eau Claire sent an email our way and is wondering, are we taking care to ensure we're not exploiting the resources the moon has? Ryan, what can you say there with Courtney's concerns about, adequately caring for the resources?
Yeah, no, this is definitely a topic that comes up a lot, and we've actually had a workshop on Artemis and ethics and exploration and how we can take care of the resources there and the environment. And I would highly recommend, I believe it's public now. I don't know the exact title of the report, but if you just like Google Artemis and ethics, you'll find a report that we wrote up about our thoughts and plans about how we can ethically explore and make sure that we're not exploiting resources. It is a very complicated, topic to walk around, but it is very important to us at NASA that, we take care of the environment we're in, while also trying to use what's there, for, scientific exploration and human exploration. So again, I highly recommend reading that report because it's got a lot more in it than I can possibly cover right now, but it is something that we're actively discussing, thinking about, talking to, industry and academia about as well.
Let's bring in Steve in Lake Geneva. Steve, hi.
Yes, hi there. You mentioned that the United Arab Emirates is already participating in this effort to explore the moon, unlock its riches, presumably. What role does the fossil fuel industry have in this form of extreme human exploration? And what is the total estimated carbon footprint for this global space race? We know robots, for instance, are becoming far more sophisticated and can potentially significantly reduce costs. We also know that we have a climate and biodiversity crisis. So I'd just like to have your scientists put that into context. Thank you very
into
much.
Into context. Steve, thank you. Ryan, you first.
Oh, yeah, that's a hard question. I'm not sure I have a very thorough answer for you. Again, I know people are thinking about these things, but I just don't, off the top of my head, know what the answer is. So I'm actually going to throw this one to Jeff to see if he's got any more to add.
And Jeff, I might add, are there efforts to work toward a more carbon neutral spaceflight program that would produce less waste? I mean, I think it was with the reusable booster rockets that the rocket, to the International Space Station. I mean, that might be an example.
Yeah, there's certainly an awareness of the need to be more sustainable in space. And sustainability, takes several different dimensions. It includes, for example, reusable rockets. It includes looking at different kinds of propellants that may have less of an impact on the environment. It means leaving less debris in orbit, where it can pose a hazard to spacecraft in the International Space Station. So certainly people are thinking about it. I don't know what the carbon footprint of the space industry is. It's probably relatively small compared to many other industries like aviation, simply because because of the sheer difference in size. And then to address the caller's question about the UAE, it's interesting is that one of the reasons why the UAE is getting involved in space is that they want to diversify their economy. They don't want to be just known as a country that produces oil, that they want to take advantage of that wealth and move into other industries. And space is one field where they see an opportunity to do that and create, you know, an economy that can last far longer than anyone that's based on fossil fuels alone.
Ryan, with the growing interest in lunar landings and the companies getting involved, are you concerned about space litter around the moon?
I'm not sure I would say I'm concerned, but I would say it's something that we definitely are talking about and thinking about, you know, with, you know, we're using some of these partners that Jeff just mentioned that have reusable spacecraft. I think we're still sorting out what aspects will be reusable and what aren't. So with Apollo, you know, you may remember that we left kind of the bottom half of the lander on the surface, as well as, you know, other trash and such. With our HLS, Human Landing System, those rockets, those landers, the whole thing will be leaving the surface. So we won't have an entire spacecraft still sitting there, but we will be leaving behind other things, you know, scientific payloads and, you know, probably some things the crew can't bring back. There may be some trash and stuff we have to leave. So as we start to look towards this increased cadence of surface missions, especially with humans, it is something we'll need to be thinking about. And I would say that those conversations are very much ongoing. And we welcome, you know, those conversations as well, because we do want to think about these things as much as we can.
Ryan Watkins is a NASA program scientist focused on the moon. Jeff Faust with us, senior staff writer at Space News. As we discuss developments in the space program, call in with a question. You can share your insights at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is music from the science fiction movie Dune Part 2 as we explore the real-life vision of NASA with its space program. We also hear your questions about getting to the moon and going beyond. Call in with a question. You can share your comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Ryan Watkins is a NASA program scientist focused on the moon. Jeff Faust is senior staff writer for Space News. Okay, Jeff, so Dune Part 2 released over the weekend, currently the best-selling movie of 2024, the year yet young. You know, how much does science fiction involving space affect our interest in real-life exploration and the work you do covering the space beat?
Well, I think that, you know, there's been a long running tie between science fiction and science fact, if you will, when it comes to space. You know, I was inspired growing up by the original Star Trek series and the movies and the Next Generation series, for example. Many other people were as well. Other people turned to Star Wars or other series and so on. So I think there's always been a deep tie between the two, linking sort of the fantasies of what could happen in space with what really is going on and what could happen in missions to come.
Ryan, how do you negotiate that line between science fiction and science fact? And I just wonder how many times you roll your eyes like when watching movies.
Well, being a scientist, I probably roll my eyes more times than I should. That being said, you know, I do appreciate science fiction. You know, it kind of shows us just ways that the human brain can dream and envision like a future in space exploration. You know, some of it may be more realistic than others, but, you know, there's certainly no harm in having these kind of fantasies about, you know, what a future of humans living and working in space could look like. You know, there's certainly, you know, so again, like I said, some things are way more realistic than others, but no harm in having these visions of the future.
And no harm in asking, do you have a favorite space movie?
Oh, goodness. So my favorite is Apollo 13. I find it is obviously not a science fiction movie. It's based on a real story, but I just find it very inspiring, just what the crew went through and how, folks on the ground had to work so hard to bring them back safely. And obviously, and it had a happy ending. So that one is definitely one of my favorites.
And for you, Jeff?
Well, Apollo 13 is a great one. I mean, growing up, I remember seeing 2001 when it made a return to the theaters a number of years after it came out, and that sort of captivated me as sort of one vision for the future. We're heading our way back to the moon. We don't have quite the space hotels yet, and hopefully we won't have HAL 9000. But other than that, it was a fascinating movie.
Okay, so back to the real life space here. Last month, Jeff, you reported that their leak on the Russian side of the International Space Station has doubled in size. Part of the station has been in space now for nearly 30 years. What do you see as the future of the International Space Station?
Well, NASA's plans and the plans of the other partners on the ISS is to keep it operational through the end of the decade to 2030. And even with the issues about the leak in that one part of the Russian segment, those plans seem to be holding up pretty well. What NASA is doing is trying to again leverage the private sector and partnerships there to develop commercial space stations that would serve as successors to the International Space Station, allowing NASA to give up the overhead and the cost of operating its own space station, and instead using those commercial space stations to carry out some of the research that Ryan mentioned earlier on in our conversation in zero gravity in Earth orbit. And so it's supporting several companies that are working on these space stations. We'll see if they get them done by 2030 or not, if they run into delays. Many programs do run into delays in the space program. But certainly that is the future, is to gradually transition from the ISS to these commercial space stations.
Ryan, in our few moments we have left, and in the years unfolding to 2026, what should we watch for next, in the Artemis mission?
Yeah, there's a lot to watch for. This is a very exciting time in lunar exploration specifically, space exploration in general, but we've got a lot going on in lunar exploration with our commercial lunar payload services program. So that's one thing to keep an eye out. We have two more launches coming up this year and several more in the following years. And those, tie in to Artemis in various ways. Keep an eye out again for the Artemis 2 mission coming up. Again, this is a crewed orbital mission around the moon. I don't remember the exact date for that off the top of my head. I believe it's coming up next year. Keep an eye out for announcement of our Artemis 3 crew. So these will be the first astronauts to set foot on the surface of the moon in over 50 years. We plan on sending the first woman and first person of color to the moon. So a lot to look out for that. And again, like Jeff was mentioning earlier, all these commercial ventures as well and how those are supporting space exploration has been really exciting to watch.
Ryan and Jeff, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
That is Jeff Faust, senior staff writer at Space News, Ryan Watkins, program scientist in NASA's Exploration Science Strategy and Integration Office focused on the moon. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.